People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and calling down the key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a foreign dynasty. If you don't love and leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning from the European heartland. Well, tomorrow, that's Sunday, the elections for the European Parliament. And there's no doubt in almost anybody's mind that the nationalist and populist parties are going to do very, very well. It'll be a big rejection of the tyrants of the European Union. One of the leaders is the, and one of the most encouraging people, is the Vice Premier of Italy, called by the name of Salvini. He represents a party called the Liga, which used to be the Liga del Norte, the Liga del Norte. So he's being really tough on immigration. Italy was being invaded by third worlders pouring across the Mediterranean. The Italian government was limp and lame and unable to do anything. It really didn't have any desire to do anything. So no government could do anything. It's a matter of will. Anyway, Salvini is a very active campaigner, and his Liga del Norte is likely to pick up a fair number of more seats in the European Parliament. Here's a speech he gave, a very short speech he gave recently. I'm going to...
Le paure e i fantasmi del passato.
I'm going to give it to you. There's English subtitles. He's waving at the crowd. We are happy to leave the ghosts and fears of the past to others. Together we are building for the future. There is no far right here.
Non c'è l'ultradestra.
There is the politics of common sense.
The
extremists are those who governed Europe for 20 years in the name of precariousness and poverty. Who betrayed Europe? Who betrayed one of the most beautiful dreams? Beautiful dreams hypothesized by the founding fathers. The Europe of nations and people, of which De Gasperi, De Gaulle, and Margaret Thatcher talked about. The Europe was betrayed by the elites and powers who occupied this Europe in the name of finance, of the multinationals, of money and uncontrolled immigration. The Merkels, the Macrons, the Soros, the Junkers. And he's there with Marine Le Pen of the Front National and various other leaders, but there are the really key words, and just in case the voiceover wasn't too good, you made it quite clear that the extremists are not the populist parties, but the usurpers, the traitors, the people who hijacked a dream of a better post-war Europe, people like French leader Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, George Soros, the Jewish financier who's been behind so many of the invasions. So these are the bad people, the ones who betrayed the hopes. Anyway, I believe he's going to be doing very, very well, and in the race, the European elections tomorrow. Oh yes, well, it doesn't seem that a day goes by that the trust fund kid, Canada's prime minister, doesn't apologize to somebody. But he never apologized. He did not apologize, for instance, to Vice Admiral Mark Norman, who was put through 2 years of hell, huge financial expenses to his family and some supporters. He did have military and other people who did financially try to support him. He took on the whole Canadian government, and luckily he had a tremendous lawyer. And you might wonder, well, what did he do? Espionage for some foreign power or something like that? No, he was accused of having leaked cabinet documents about the procurement of a naval supply vessel, and it turned out that he'd done no such thing. But the government was desperate to punish somebody for embarrassing leaked documents. See, the Liberal government wanted to, a newly elected Liberal government of Justin Trudeau in 2015, wanted to give the contract to financial backers, rather than to the previous conservative government had given it to, and the Davy shipyards in Quebec. Now, this is not, it was a matter of great urgency that this ship be built. Anyway, they needed a scapegoat, and it was to be Admiral Norman. He has been through 3 years of hell, 2 years of hell. In the end, his excellent lawyer established such a body of material, of evidence, and the RCMP did an absolutely incompetent a job of investigating. In fact, they never even bothered to interview Norman. I mean, like the chief suspect sort of thing. I mean, just horrible. Anyway, the charges were withdrawn by the Crown a little over a week ago. And last week, the House of Commons unanimously gave him an apology. Now, that's not the full apology that ought to come from the government, but on a motion by the Conservatives, even Liberals voted for it. But interestingly, the Sikh Minister of Defense, Hajjan, stepped out of the House of Commons, as did Prime Minister Trudeau. But anyway, this week Trudeau was in Saskatchewan, And he was apologizing yet again. You might wonder, now, you know, if you apologize for things he did, that might be good. You know, we all have both the power and probably the duty to apologize for things we do. But how do you apologize for things other people did? Well, that's more difficult, isn't it? But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Thursday exonerated an Indian chief convicted of treason after a battle with federal forces almost 135 years ago. Trudeau apologized during a visit to a Saskatchewan Indian tribe that bears the name of Chief Poundmaker. Poundmaker was a Cree. They helpfully give you how to say his name in Cree, but that's a jawbreaker, and I won't even go there. He was born in 1842 near Battleford, Saskatchewan. During the Battle of Cutknife Hill in May 1885, he stopped warriors from pursuing the retreating federal troops. That's the Canadian troops who'd been sent in to punish some Cree for an attack and some looting. This was a normal policing or military policing operation. He was unfairly labeled as a rebel, Russell Fayance said, who teaches Indigenous history and Métis culture at the University of Regina. He was a peacemaker and urged his people not to attack again. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but was released within a year because of ill health. He died a few months later at age about 44. Now, one of the things that struck me as odd in this, he was charged with treason. Now, treason is a very, very serious charge, and in the normal course of things, could land a person in one could be face capital punishment for. Well, what happened to Poundmaker? Well, he was given all of 3 years in prison, and then released after about a year because of ill health. Now, it doesn't sound to me like searing brutality. Anyway, we've apologized for that. I was talking to a very good friend of mine last night, and the friend was telling me about a historical event that does not get a lot of press. In fact, it's almost gone down the memory hole, and it involved an attack by the Iroquois on what is now a village, which is now Lachine in Quebec. This is back in I believe 1680. And at that battle, at that surprise attack, 200 French settlers were killed. Now, have the Iroquois apologized for that? You know, if we're going to go and have a series of apologies for all the things done wrong in the past, wouldn't it be fair if both sides apologized? But wouldn't that make some sense? Well, I think it would. Here's my local paper. I now live in Hamilton, Ontario. Here's my paper for today. This is the Hamilton Spectator. And, there's a number of things in it, but there are a couple of crime stories that intrigue me. And let me see here. There are actually a couple stories, I wanted to deal with both of them. Police seek witnesses in Tim Hortons shooting. Now, that's not, Tim Hortons wasn't shot. Tim Hortons is a popular chain of restaurants, so that's the location of the shooting. Hamilton police are looking to speak to four witnesses after an attempted murder outside the downtown Tim Hortons this month. A 16-year-old boy from Stony Creek, that's a suburb of Hamilton, was charged with attempted murder and other firearms offenses. 16 years old. But he, of course, can't be named under because he's a young offender. Another teen who was with the group was not involved in the shooting at this Tim Hortons outlet was charged with an unrelated drug offense. Police were searching for a third suspect. Now they hope to speak with four witnesses who were near the shooting. These are the witnesses. Well, they're investigators believe that that one of the witnesses had been at the Vita La Pita next door to the Tim Hortons. Almost certainly, the victim and the shooters were black. This is just my local paper, and this is one day. Accused in mob hit, denied bail. Jabril Abdallah, age 27, charged in the Angelo Musitano murder. Musitano had connections with the mafia. A 27-year-old Hamilton man charged in two organized crime shootings, including the murder of Hamilton mobster Angelo Musitano, has been denied bail. Jabril Abdallah is charged with two counts of first-degree murder, one count of attempted murder, and three counts of conspiracy to commit murder in the May 2nd, 2017 slaying of the 39-year-old Hamilton mobster, Mr. Musitano. Wearing tan pants, a gray sweater over a dress shirt, his head closely shaved, Abdallah stared ahead and quietly listened to Superior Court Justice Dale Parayeski swiftly announced his decision after hearing brief submissions from the Crown and the defense. Not mentioned in this story, but you would know this from the picture of Mr. Jabril Abdallah. He's the accused, he's actually accused in two murders. He's black, he's Somali, but he's also a resident of Hamilton. Okay, here's another crime story. Third suspect sought in deadly stabbing. Hamilton police are asking for the public's help in finding a third suspect wanted for first-degree murder and the stabbing of Carell Deuce. Carell Deuce is a black. His mother was weeping profusely as he was buried a few days ago, saying that the death has stalked her family. One of her, relatives died of a death overdose. Another son was murdered, and her police said Friday they have identified the third suspect as Aliu Jing. Now, there's a picture of Aliu Jing. He's also a Negro. He's from Toronto. On Thursday, police said Daniel Weiss, 28, of Hamilton, and Samatar Hassan, of course, Middle Eastern and or black, of Toronto, were wanted for first-degree murder. Douse died from multiple sharp force injuries last week, and when he was attacked, stabbed to death. It began inside a barbershop, more than a haircut, on King Street, east in Hamilton, and three people then chased Douse outside, heading north on East Avenue, where the attack continued. He was stabbed in the front porch of a home. Police arrived and died shortly afterwards. Police previously released images of two of the three suspects wanted in the death and released the third photo on Friday. A group of people were at the barbershop after hours for a private gathering before the assault began. It's unclear what time all of those involved arrived and if more than one had a knife. Look, what does one make of this sad story? Well, the victim, Mr. Douse, comes from a family that's, as they say, not unknown to violence and drugs, and he was stabbed to death. Now, this is a private gathering in a barbershop of blacks, and the three people being sought for the murder are obviously black. And this is in a, Hamilton is a city where I doubt the black population is more than perhaps 1 or 2%. Now, what's happening here? Well, what is happening and what is not mentioned, of course, in the paper are very, very controlled fake news media. What's not mentioned is, of course, that the color of crime very often is black. Well, that's right. Blacks come in crimes out of all relationship to their proportion of the population. And that's not a Hamilton phenomena. It's not even just a an Ontario phenomenon. It's a phenomenon throughout much of the world. It's an American phenomenon. The color of crime overwhelmingly is black. Blacks in Toronto, and these statistics go back a couple of years, constitute about 7 or 8% of the population, and yet they constitute the, in terms of violent crimes, commit about 75% of the violent crimes defined as rape, armed robbery, murder. I mean, just like out of all proportion. To their share of the population. Now, there's a picture. This is, I want to thank Dr. James Sanchez for sending this on to me. There's a picture of a very good-looking woman. Her name is Annette Keneally, and she was murdered. And this story comes from South Africa. And the person who sent it is a other person I know in South Africa named Dan Root. And Dan asks, one of hundreds of whites, South African whites, brutally, callously murdered, and still no condemnation by the European Union or British government or the media. What will it take to break this indifference? And I wish I knew. I wish I had the answer. And here are the particulars. This is Dan Roots, a friend, an activist for rural safety. Annette Keneally has herself become a victim of a vicious farm murder. She was apparently beaten to death with a pipe and a hammer on her small holding outside of Louis Trichardt. That's a city in South Africa. She served as a municipal councillor for 4 years and was always full of energy. She loved dogs and horses. The entire community up there in Louis Trichardt is grieving. Together with everyone who knew her. She was very brave and always carried her gun, a 9mm Astra pistol on her. Evidently, her preparedness was not enough to save her in the end. Either she was killed by somebody she knew, a number of her employees are being questioned in connection with her murder. But may she rest in peace, but may the shock of her death also set us thinking about our future in this country, which has fallen into an abyss of evil, rapacity, and bloodlust. Please share them with your friends overseas. More than ever, we need your support and prayers, as so many of us are senselessly murdered while all the anti-white propaganda is pumped out again and again and again about this. And this is the sad reality of South Africa. I've been there, and I know what I'm talking about. It is pathetic what has happened to South Africa, and more pathetic is the fact there is so little interest on the part of the mass media in the West and of white leadership. You know, an absolute scandal of what's being done. Here is a piece by Carolyn Yeager, and it's about a woman who was taken off to jail a couple of days ago. I believe it was Thursday in Germany. Her name is Sylvia Stoltz. Sylvia is a brave German lawyer. She was stripped of her license to practice law because she too vigorously defended Ernst Zundel. She also went to jail for that. She served 3.5 years in jail for that. Back in 2012, she was addressing a free speech group in Switzerland. And at that, she was not talking about Germany's notorious, she was not talking about Holocaust revisionism. She was talking about the application of Germany's notorious Section 130 of their criminal code, which is the anti-free speech provisions under what they call racial incitement of the masses, but it has nothing to do with what you and I would normally consider incitement, which would be urging people to go out and commit some crime. That's not the case at all. It basically is the law that makes it impossible, or I should say very, very dangerous, to question the Hollywood version of World War II. And here's the report by Carolyn Jaeger. I also have reports from Lady Michelle Renouf in Germany and in Britain, and Peter Rushton, who put this up on the website of Heritage and Destiny, a paper he co-edits. Sylvia Stoltz arrested to be jailed again for 18 months. For what? Asks Carolyn Jaeger. In the morning hours of May 23rd, Frau Sylvia Stoltz was arrested at her place of residence by the helpers of the Federal Republic of Germany's so-called justice system. The prison sentence results from the legally binding judgment of February 15th of last year, against which appeals and constitutional complaints were filed. On November 24th, 2012, in Chur, Switzerland, Sylvia Stoltz, the revisionist leader, gave a lecture at the 8th International Conference of the Anti-Censorship Coalition, entitled Spechverbot, Beweisverbot, Verteidigung, Verbot, I won't say the rest of it, but in the lecture, the fully qualified lawyer subjected the criminal proceedings for so-called Holocaust denial to substantiated legal scientific criticism with regard to the problem of criminal law determination. On February 25th, 2015, the Munich Regional Court, number 2, in the first instance, imposed 1 year and 6 months in prison without probation for Holocaust denial. So that's her first conviction. And in the judgment, placed great emphasis on her earlier denial, conviction for her Holocaust denial in 2008. I'm sorry, that was the first thing she was convicted under. At the first appeal, in May 3rd of 2016, the Federal Court of Justice reversed the judgment with regard to the sentence and referred the case back to the Munich Regional Court number 2 for new sentencing. Reasons for the revocation were acquittal with regard to abuse of professional title and error with regard to the penalty frame for Holocaust denial. So these are kind of obscure legal points. The judgment of the regional court in Munich on February 25th, 2018, was 1 year and 6 months in prison. The chamber declared itself bound by the conviction in the first instance. The first instance judgment of February 15, 2015, however, generates neither binding effect nor partial legal force. This is certainly not easy for laymen to understand, but for people who call themselves jurists, this should be a very clear case. All motions submitted in this case, including those of the defense counsel, as well as the appeal for revision and the appeal for fundamental rights, are suitable to bear witness to the violations committed by those who uphold Germany's notorious anti-free speech laws. For decent people, this renewed act of power demonstration is no reason to bury their heads in the sand. With each blow to which the dying beast, the Federal Republic of Germany and its backers, still reaches out, it drives more people into the light. The clearer the beast proves its helplessness by the fact that it can keep up the lies only by using violence, the sooner its situation becomes clear to the enslaved people. 18 months that Sylvia Stoltzma now faces means she must sit in prison, along with the 90-year-old Ursula Haverback, in prison for the same crime. Questioning the Hollywood version of World War II. 90-year-old woman. And they're there because there are still too many ignorant people, cowards, and hypocrites in our ranks. And we'll be watching the German results in the European elections because Ursula Haverback is running for the European Parliament. And of course, if she wins a seat, this will be a huge problem, an immense problem for the dark forces. What are they to do? A person's elected who's in prison. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But the results we hope will be positive, and we'll be out. We expect probably late on Sunday night we should have some information. And here's something from CODO. That's the Committee for an Open Debate on the Holocaust. Gee, it was nice to have open debates on things, isn't it? And this is called An Awful Revenge by John Ware. The Eastern Victors concentration camps after World War II. The Eastern Victors continued to operate many formerly German concentration camps after World War II. Additional camps to intern ethnic Germans were established in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Yugoslavia. Probably hadn't heard that one, had you? Unless you're extremely well informed. Certainly, we don't get much about this in the fake news media, do we? I'm having a lot of trouble with my internet, so I'm a pop-up has just suddenly blocked my screen. Okay. While the operation of the post-war camps is a matter of major historical significance, the population of the German concentration camp system had grown to a record peak of 700,000 by the beginning of 1945. That's those in German detention camps. The number of Germans incarcerated across Europe in similar camps by the end of 1945 was even higher. There were Soviet-run camps. The German concentration camps at Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, Mühlberg, Fürstenwald, Liebroß, Bautzen, and other locations were taken over by the Russians and became part of the Gulag Archipelago. The camp at Buchenwald, for example, was transformed into Special Camp Number 2 and was operated by the Soviet Union until 1950. Conditions at the camps under the Soviets were atrocious. The camps were labeled special because the Soviets insisted that the internees be cut off completely from the civilian population. Even General Merkulov, the Soviet official in charge of the concentration camps in Germany, acknowledged a severe lack of order and cleanliness, particularly at Buchenwald. One former inmate described his 5 years in the Soviet-run Buchenwald camp. People were mere numbers. Their dignity was consciously trampled upon. They were starved without mercy and consumed by tuberculosis until they were skeletons. The annihilation process, which had been well tested over decades in Russia, was systematic. The cries and groans of those in pain still echo in my ears whenever the past comes back to me in sleepless nights. We had to watch helplessly as people perished according to plan, like creatures sacrificed to annihilation. Many nameless people were caught up in the annihilation machinery of the NKVD. That was the Soviet secret police, the predecessor to the KGB. These people were herded like cattle after the so-called liberation and vegetated in many concentration camps. Many were systematically tortured to death. A memorial was built for the dead of the Buchenwald concentration camp. A figure of death victims was chosen based on fantasy. Intentionally, only the dead of the 1937-1945 period were honored. That is the ones when Buchenwald was controlled by the National Socialists. Why is there no memorial honoring the dead of 1945 to 1950? Countless mass graves were dug around the camp in the post-war period. While no one knows the exact number of inmates and deaths at Buchenwald, it's reasonably certain a higher percentage of inmates died under Soviet control than under German control. Viktor Suvorov estimates that 28,000 people were imprisoned by the Soviets at Buchenwald from 1945 to 1950. Of whom 7,000, or roughly 25%, died. By comparison, he estimates that the 250,000 people imprisoned by the Germans at Buchenwald from 1937 to 1945. Of that number, Suvorov estimates that about 20% died. The Soviet-run Buchenwald had a higher estimated death rate than the German-run Buchenwald. And near the end of the war, there was good reason that there were a lot of deaths. There was typhus that was widespread in the German detention camps, and there was a severe lack of food. So people were starving. Of course, made them all more susceptible to illness. Suvorov's estimates of deaths at Soviet-run Buchenwald are probably understated. Some sources estimate that at least 13,000 and as many as 21,000 people died in the Soviet-run Buchenwald. Also, a detailed June 1945 U.S. government report on German-run Buchenwald put the death total at a lower number of about 33,462, of whom more than 20,000 died in the final chaotic months of the war. Of starvation or of typhus. and all the deaths were not execution for the most part. The death rate percentage of the Soviet, those deaths total include at least 400 estimates killed in British bombing raids of Buchenwald when it was still under the control of the Germans. Thus, the death rate percentage at the Soviet-run Buchenwald versus the German-run Buchenwald is probably substantially higher than even Suvorov's estimates. Suvorov was a Russian high-ranking official who wrote some very interesting books near the end of his career. Russian estimates show a total of 122,000 and change Germans passed through the Soviet-run camps in the Soviet zone after the end of the war. Of this total, 42,000 Germans died, or roughly 35%. The official Soviet statistics probably underestimate the true number of dead in the Soviet-run camps. American military intelligence units and Social Democratic Party groups in the late 1940s and 50s estimate that a much higher total of about 240,000 German prisoners passed through the Soviet-run camps and an estimated 95,000 or 40% died. In these revisions were 60,000 prisoners at Sachsenhausen, where 26,143 died, or roughly nearly a half. 36,000 prisoners at Buchenwald, where 13,200 did not survive, again about 40%. And 30,000 prisoners at Bautzen, where 16,700 died, again about 40%. The higher death counts are supported by discoveries of numerous mass graves of Germans buried near these Soviet camps. No one has ever been punished for the deaths and mistreatment of German inmates in the post-war Soviet-run camps. The hundreds of thousands of visitors who visit the Buchenwald campsite each year only see museums and memorials dedicated to the so-called victims of fascism or the so-called Holocaust. There's nothing at Buchenwald to remind the visitors of the thousands of Germans who perished miserably in Buchenwald after the war, when the camp was run by the Soviet Union, by the communists. This is one of the battles we have to fight as we try to reclaim our history and our heritage and to shed light on what really happened. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I'm going to try to play, actually, a song by Pam Tillis. This is Don't Tell Me What to Do. Some internet problems, so I'm going to switch to another source here. For my musical interlude tonight, I'm going to play some tunes by Hank Williams Jr. Of course, Hank Williams Sr.'s son for many years, really in his dad's shadow. His dad, of course, passed away all too young at age 29, and for a while, Hank Jr. Found himself under his dad's shadow.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. A woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I've got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. But you can't solve a fire.
They're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can
Hank Williams Jr.
Arkansas, but if I hadn't been riding on Tennessee stud,
playing some songs by Hank Williams Jr. That's the Tennessee Stud. And this one's Rambling in My Shoes. False start there. That's a great one by Hank Williams Jr. And that's Ramblin' My Shoes. One more one. And this is a real popular one by him.
Every
that's Hank Williams Jr. All my rowdy friends have settled down. This is Paul Fromm, you're on the fighting side of me, here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show's repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, all of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, forever. This is Paul Fromm.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave, our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf.